Well, thank you, Norm. I have been talking with you, and first I'd like to just give you an update on the sleep lab. Be sure and ask me questions as we go. But we've been busy. It's been a busy year. Gosh, I'm surprised. I worked at the sleep lab up north, and we aren't just as busy as we were there, if not busier at the time. So it's been great. We've done so far 154 patients, at least 154 studies. That's an average of about 3.5 a week, which has kept me going. You know, full time is 3 days a week, so I've been working overtime a lot. We've seen a lot of different types of patients from different areas. We had a 7-year-old in 2 weeks. We went on to an 11-year-old here just a while ago. Interesting patients, and we thought they do. We're not really set up for a lab for infants. We won't do infants, but children are old enough to sit for long enough to be put out and sleep okay, and we could do children based on Dr. Schrader's advice. We've got 85-year-old patients and everywhere in between. So it's been a good mix. We've got patients in our Falls, Tetonia, Pocatello, Pinedale, Big Piney, then one in Ogden. Of course, we do have quite a few patients in the summer that are here for the summer. You know, everywhere in Texas, you know, St. George. The lab has been good. We've got it. Ideal situation, the best in Wyoming, if not in any state. I just got back from a sleep conference. I don't know of any other lab that's set up better than we are. We've got a registered tech, we got a sleep doctor, and we got now a 2-bed lab. All we need is patients, and we're getting some of them, they're getting a good group of those. We have the expertise, we've got the equipment, and I think we're seeing good results with the patients. Do you have any questions about the sleep lab in general? Just any?
I sort of have a quickie. Now, I have to say this, you can all laugh at me. But when you first did a presentation and said there was a sleep lab going in the hospital, at first I sort of said, oh, yeah, right. I mean, this is a valley where everybody works so very hard. There's a lot of farmers, and the women work hard and this and that. I don't see people in the valley having trouble sleeping. But evidently that's not true at all, is it?
A lot of these patients, that's a good point as part of my presentation, a lot of these patients don't know they have a sleep disorder. They're sleeping and they don't know they've got a disorder.
I'd be interested in seeing a statistic of the number of patients that you have that are literally have grown up in the valley as opposed to the ones that have moved into the valley. But anyway.
I don't have that number. But we do have demographics. I don't have it with me today, but we have quite a few from outside the valley. But why would you want to know that?
Because again, it's my thought that the people that have grown up here in such a pleasant, wonderful, serene place,
low
doing
stress,
doing hard farm work, would not be stressed enough to have a sleep disorder, right?
I hate to tell you, that's wrong. I'm probably going to tell you more about sleep than you want to know today. So stop me if you know, or just tell me to move on. Technologists seem to get excited about their work. I'm going to show you a little bit more detail than I probably ought to, but I want you to understand sleep apnea. Obstructive sleep apnea, I think you all know what it is. It's an obstruction in the throat that blocks off air. And apnea is a Greek word meaning without air, and it's defined as not breathing for 10 seconds or more. Sleep apnea has two major problems. One is quality of life, and this slide shows a little bit of that. Here the gentleman snoring away, and his wife is just up all night, who's getting the sleep. Both of them are deprived of good rest, and then of course falling asleep on the computer. What I'm finding is most of our patients, the majority of the patients, are coming because of spouses. They don't recognize that they have a problem. I want to bring this up so as you talk to your friends and family, they don't realize they have a problem. They're snoring, they're sleeping, and some of them feel tired, some I get come in, feel tired, but yet after years of feeling tired, I don't think know the difference as much. So quality of life is a big issue. Is why most patients come in. It's because they realize if a spouse sends them in, because they're not getting sleep, or the individual is tired during the day. Most of them come in for that reason rather than probably the is equal important, if not more important. How serious is obstructive sleep apnea? Well, it's a cause they've proven a contributor to high blood pressure, cardiac problems, abnormal heart rhythms, heart attack, and heart failure, increased insulin resistance even in non-diabetic patients, stroke, increased traffic and workplace accidents, memory problems and ability to think correctly. And these are just a few, and they're major ones. And again, the problem with obstructive sleep apnea is the longer it goes, the more damage it does. It's kind of like, you know, getting a cavity. You don't go, so a lot of people don't go to the dentist until it starts hurting. That's the way we receive a lot of our patients. They won't come to the sleep lab until it gets so bad they can't sleep and they're having major problems, and they've had these problems for 20 years and it's finally causing health issues. Does it cause death? Most certainly. Traffic accidents, as we just mentioned, is a big killer for sleep apnea patients. And Reggie White, I don't know if any of you remember Reggie White, but he's died about 42 years of age of sleep apnea. So they think from the autopsy.
I'm sorry, he died of sleep apnea? He didn't have a car accident. He died in his sleep?
Correct.
Ooh. There's a healthy guy.
Yeah, there's an athlete, football player. As I get you going here, I think you'll have a better feel for it. Let me just talk about sleep apnea for a second. This is a normal airway. Look, if I sit down and run this mouse, nobody minds. This is a normal airway. When you lay down, this is what it should look like when you go to sleep. This is a hypopnea. It's a partial airway restriction. Some patients just have hypopneas, and some patients have obstruction and hypopneas. Hypopneas and obstructive apneas are both a problem. And this is obstructive apnea. This is when there is a blockage of air. And it takes an arousal of the brain to wake up the tissues in your body, to open them up so you can breathe again. And also with hypopneas, there's also usually an arousal with the brain. Now, where in the heck is my... Oh, there it is. I lost it. What happens during an apneic event? Your airway collapses. Your oxygen level drops. Your heart changes rate rapidly. Your brain sends out an alarm to wake up and breathe. Your sleep is interrupted as you awaken and gasp for air. Your airway collapses, and it's a repetitive, endless cycle during the night for many patients. And again, a lot of patients don't even know they have the problem. We measure the apneic events during sleep study. So we have an apnea hypopnea index. That refers to a measurement of on a per hour basis of how many of these events a patient has. And why is it important? It's important towards treatment of the patient. 0 to 5 is normal. We all have hypopneas and apneas during the night. So 0 to 5 an hour is normal, and we don't need to treat that. 5 to 15 is mild. 15 to 40 is moderate, and over 40 is severe. So every patient that comes to the sleep lab, we do have an AHI for them.
Oh, that's in an hour measured?
That's in an hour. That's an average.
Over 40 in an hour?
Yes, sir. Now, a patient may have 80 in 1 hour and 20 in another and 30 in another, but over the night. I'm going to show you here in a minute a patient with 110 an hour. Just to refresh your memory, I don't remember, I think you were in a group where we were at the sleep lab and we talked about hookup, patient leads. There's 24 sensors. These sensors convert to frequencies on my computer. So this is what I'm monitoring when I'm looking at the patient at night. This is a normal tracing. We call it an epoch. It's a 30-second period of time. These four channels are brain waves. This is stage three sleep. I don't know if you remember or not. There's non-REM and REM. Non-REM has stages 1, 2, 3, 4, and REM is a separate stage. So these are the brain waves. Right eye, left eye, chin. Now in this tracing, there's artifacts from the pulse of a blood vessel. That's what's causing this little marks. You see it lines up with the heart rate. And it goes up into the EEG also. It's not a problem, so, and I didn't correct it because it's not a problem. It's just an issue where a patient has large blood vessels and I get artifact in the tracing.
What is it the chin, what is it actually monitoring?
The chin is monitoring muscle tone. Now there's a chin EMG and a muscle tone monitoring, and there's a leg. And I only have one channel. I could put a leg channel for muscle tone too, but we only monitor the chin. So when you're awake, you have muscle tone. As you go to sleep, you lose muscle tone, and you start to relax. And that's when you start having problems with your obstructive apnea. Mm-hmm. Your muscles relax, collapse, especially as you get older or obese, and that's part of the contributor to sleep apnea. This right here, the chin will change during the night, depending on the stage of sleep. It's largest when you're awake. It's less with every stage. It goes less in stage 1, 2, 3, 4, and it's the smallest in REM sleep. In REM sleep, you have very low muscle tone. This is the snore channel. There's no snoring. This is, again, the EKG, monitoring the heart. We monitor a 2-beat heart rhythm. This is the pulse. You see the pulse is good. Right leg, left leg for leg movement. This is the airflow. This patient is on CPAP, and that's why this looks so good, because I don't have a patient to meet that comes to me like this. If they were like this, they wouldn't come. So this is the mask pressure, breathing in the mask. This is the lungs, expansion, contraction, and the abdomen, pulling and pushing for air. RNR, I'm not going to cover, it's too complicated. SpO2 is your oxygen level. Normal is 88 and above at night and 90 and above during the day, although most physicians like to see a patient above 90 at night too.
How do you arrive at that oxygen level?
With a pulse ox on the finger. That's the monitor that gives us the...
So you can actually measure through their finger how much oxygen is in their blood?
Yeah, we're measuring oxygen saturation in the tissue.
In the blood. Okay.
The pleth is a trans channel, a trend of O2. And then the CPAP level, this patient's on 18, pressure of 18, in the supine position, so he's on his back. This is what a normal EEG would look like, pretty close. Now let me show you quickly what an obstructive apnea looks like. This is the snore channel. You can see this patient is snoring at the end of every apnea. This record's already been scored, so that's why it's high. Everything's high that is going on. So he doesn't snore, and then he snores. That's because he's sucking in air when his brain finally wakes him up, and he snorts. That's a typical apnea pattern for snoring. There's two different measurements of airflow that we put on a patient: the thermistor and the cannula. Both of them go in the nose. One measures volume of air, and the other measures waveform. So this breathing pattern should look more like this. But you can see there's some air movement, so it's not a total obstruction, but mostly obstructed. These are obstructive apneas. The chest is still trying to pull and push air. The abdomen is still trying to pull and push air. But it's not till this point right here that the patient gets air. Or at least substantial air. This is the oxygen level. You can see how it goes up to 87. And then when they have an apnea, from this apnea right here, the patient's dropping down to 76, 66, 61, 58, 55. And then he breathes right here. And then the oxygen level follows later because it's behind, it takes the blood, a little while to get oxygen to the blood, the heart, that is. So it goes back up, and then he has another apnea, starts going back down, and it's a roller coaster like that all night long. Any questions on that? Now this is a central apnea. Central apneas are not an obstruction. It's when the brain doesn't communicate with the abdomen and doesn't tell it to that it needs air. So you have a central apnea when you hold your breath, for example. There's enough oxygen in your lungs so your brain doesn't tell you to breathe, so you don't breathe for a period. The cause of central apneas, generally is neurological, it's medication, it's alcohol-related, as well as obstructive can be. It's drug abuse, it's brain damage, disability of birth or a problem at birth with the neurological conditions. The effect is the same. There's no effort to breathe, however. That's what makes it a central apnea. Because the abdomen doesn't try to breathe, and neither does the lungs. You don't have any effort. But the oxygen is still going up and down, as you can see. Okay, now this is what my patients look like. Luckily, not all of them. So I wanted to show you what's going on in this individual's body. He's a 48-year-old male. He weighs 330 pounds, so granted he's overweight. I chose his record because it was the easiest to show examples. I have patients who are not obese that have the same problem. He was not aware of any sleep disorder. He came because his wife sent him. He didn't feel like he was deprived of sleep and felt like he was getting rest. In his EEG, now this is condensed. These are 30-second right here. So we're looking at 5 minutes instead of the last frame we were looking at 2 minutes. So I'm giving you a bigger screen so you can see what's going on over a period of 5 minutes. In his EEG, every time he has an apnea, this is an arousal where his brain wakes up. And you follow that down to his event. These are hypopneas. And I'll show you that in a second. His eyes aren't moving. Look at his chin EMG. He's got a lot of muscle tone, which means he's not getting good rest. Look at his snoring. With hypopneas, there's more snoring on a continual basis because of more air movement. His EKG is too small to see, but you can see his pulse. 86, 94, 73, 87, 95, 91, 83. It's on a roller coaster with his hypopneas, 100. Just keeps going up and down, trying to pump blood into his system every time he has an apnea. These are his legs. Look at his movement of his legs with every apnea. Yeah.
Is this something that helps diagnose RLS, restless leg syndrome, and things like that?
Exactly. These are a result of an arousal, EEG arousal, the leg movement is. When legs cause an arousal, then you don't have an apnea right here, but you'd have a leg movement and then an arousal. So it would appear different on the EEG record. But yes, this is where they show up. Okay, these are hypopneas because you can see there's a lot of air movement. In his flow, though, the volume of air, you can see how it flattens and then he wakes up and breathes. Flattens, his brain wakes up and breathes. Although he does have some air movement. That's why they call these hypopneas, because there is some air movement, but the damage is almost as bad as obstructive apneas. And you can see that his lungs and his abdomen are still trying to get air. His oxygen, you see it go up and down. This is a 5 minute, guys sleep for 8 hours, and this is 5 minutes of it. So you imagine what this does over time. Now this is obstructive apneas, and the reason I wanted to show you this slide is because so you see the difference of the severity. The EEGs are much more dominant, prominent, and severe. Here he's got snoring with every apnea. Look at his pulse, 62, 84. 62, 103, 68, 103, 67, constantly up and down. That is working your heart. These are the obstructive apneas themselves. You can see the effort to breathe. Here's his oxygen, 59. Remember, normal is 88 and above. 73, 56, 55, 83, 58, 55, 62. So you can see the damage that's being done in this individual's body. Now this is a summary of the night. It gives you the trend. Here's his oxygen. A normal individual, and I'll show you in a minute, would be a straight line across, pretty much. You can see how he gets into his different stages of sleep, and his oxygen just goes in the toilet, just from 88 down to 66, and look at it over here. This is his heart. Look at his heart going up and down all night long. This right here, by the way, is when he got up to go to the bathroom. These are the apneas, obstructive apneas and hypopneas that we were looking at just a minute ago. This is his sleep stage, and it shows us the stages of sleep. So he's in stage 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, back up to 2, 3, and then he's awake when he goes to the bathroom, and go back to sleep, 2, 3, and then REM. You can see how much more severe his problem is in REM. This is typical for most individuals. Their biggest problem is usually in REM. He's also in a supine position. So he's on his back in REM sleep. That's where you have the biggest problem with most individuals. Now, this individual, we did a split night on, where we diagnosed him the first third of the night and hoped we have enough time to get him fixed by the end of the night. So I woke him up here to put a mask on him. I started him at pressure of 8. Now, CPAP is based on how much a column of water is raised by pressure. I don't know if you guys know that or not, but 5 centimeters of H2O is how much pressure it takes to raise a column of water, 5 centimeters. We breathe at about 5 or 6 centimeters. That's our normal breathing. I went to 8, 10, 12, 17, and 8. It wasn't until I got up to 18 that you can see I had breakthrough, and he started showing normal. This is a normal pattern right here. So we finally accomplished our goal by the end of the night with this individual.
So you're saying it took more to force the air down into his chest to open the obstruction and force the air down?
Correct. Some patients it takes 5, 6, 7, you know. Most patients are between 8 and 14. I did have one patient get up to 22. That's the highest I've gone. The machine will go up to 30. I just want to show you another pattern. This is a different patient. This patient had all of his obstructions right here. In the supine position. No obstructions on his right side. Look at all the obstructive apneas, and they were long ones. Look at his oxygen. Look at his oxygen on his right side. He goes on his back, look at that. Then on the right side, he did have some problems in REM. This, he went into REM sleep here and had some obstructions and desaturation of oxygen. And then again in supine, and again in supine.
Would you guess that would be like the tongue falling back into the throat, and then when he goes on his side, it doesn't? Or is it more than that?
It's not always that that's the case, but that it was with this individual. Usually that is the case. Sometimes a patient will have more obstructions on his side than his back.
Really?
Yeah. It just depends on the patient's anatomy. But the majority of them are worse on their back, for sure.
There's no reference on his left side there to know whether that'd be better or worse. Right side.
Yeah, go to his left. We tried to get a patient to sleep on their left and their right and the back during studies so we can try to fix the worst problem. But some patients have a sore shoulder or whatever, and they just can't initiate sleep on a certain position. So this may be for these patients, I don't know. But you're right, just supine and right is the only positions he had. Here's another.
They sleep on their stomach.
Yes. And they have apneas on their stomach too. Not as many on their stomach, but usually it's younger, 40 and younger, to sleep on their stomach. Now, this patient had this problem, actually, it's a female, in REM only. Now, she's on supine, right. Let's see this. I'm not sure if that was, didn't show up. But you can see all of her problems were in REM, 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 REM. So I just show you this because, you know, every patient's different. We all, people have problems with sleep. It's not the same with any individual, and nor is the treatment.
So a diagnosis of someone that only has the problem in REM, you would say the cause might be, as an example? Still the same old obstruction or something different?
No, the therapy is the same, whether it's in REM or other stages of sleep. The significance of that is that patient is going to have more daytime sleepiness probably than a patient that has it in non-REM. Hmm. Because REM is more restorative to the mind, and she's getting aroused here several times during one of the most important phases of sleep. Hmm. And so the treatment would be the same. The other significance of this is if we get a patient that comes in and they never sleep in the sleep lab like they do at home, they never sleep at home two nights in a row the same. And so they come into the lab, they might not get into REM sleep until right here. And we might not even diagnose the problem until they've been in the lab for 6 hours. Hmm. And so we can't do a split night. That's why we don't do split night on all patients. We have to be able to diagnose them in the first 2 hours to even think about it. It also takes 4 hours to usually to titrate them and get them there. Of course, the treatment of choice for all of this is CPAP. I thought this was how's that for that to be?
It's more like a firefighter than a
astronaut. Most people don't realize too, I think, that masks are very small and comfortable to wear today. This is one of the nasal pillow masks. They're just pillows that go in the nostrils. There's no mouthpiece. This is just some plastic framework to hold it in position. Very comfortable to wear. This is a slide I showed you earlier with this patient's disorder and his summary sheet. This is the summary sheet after CPAP. So you can see what a huge difference in sleep. Any questions on any of that so far? Okay, that's really all I'm going to go into with you. I was hoping I could just understand the problem that we have with patients recognizing they have a problem and wanting to come in and get it fixed because they don't realize what it's doing to their body, and maybe you can help us spread the word. I want to give you some things that are out new to give you an idea of the capability of our sleep lab. There's an app called Complex Sleep Apnea that's been discovered a couple of years ago, and now they have the equipment to treat it. Complex sleep apnea cannot be treated successfully with CPAP or bilevel machines, and this machine was developed to treat it. And what happens, this is a complex sleep apnea patient that we had in our lab. This patient had obstructive hypopneas right here. I was able to diagnose it first third of the night, woke him up, put a mask on him, started bumping the pressure up, he started having more hypopneas right here, and bumped the pressure up some more, and then all of a sudden he started having central apneas like crazy. This is complex sleep apnea. A patient, you treat them for obstructive apneas, and after you treat them, then they start going central. And what happens with these patients is there's an abnormal mix of air in their lungs. When you give them CPAP, they get too much oxygen in their lungs, and there's a disorder in their brain where the brain thinks it doesn't have to breathe as much anymore because there's enough oxygen there because CPAP is delivering. So they quit breathing. They start to have central apneas. So these are as bad as these. So if you haven't fixed anything, all you've done is create another problem. And this was a problem in the past. There's nothing we did. The patients just either didn't wear it or they did. And some doctors felt like they were better off to be like this and be like this, and some didn't treat it. But anyway, this machine now, this is the same patient on complex on this AutoSV is what it's called, the machine. It's servo ventilation. That's what it's called. And this is an all-night study on servo ventilation. And you can see how it corrected the problem. And now this patient has successful treatment. So that's the reason I brought this up is we're one of the few labs in Wyoming that has this equipment, that has a tech that knows how to use it, that has the equipment, and a doctor that knows how to submit the paperwork to get reimbursed. So it's something that on the edge.
Is the equipment called something in particular?
Yes, it's called servo-ventilation. Oh. Adaptive servo-ventilation.
Oh, you mean this particular, but not the whole night? Oh, okay, never mind.
Any questions? Here's something else that's coming out. It's a screening device. Now, this costs the hospital or whoever buys them about $500 a piece. But the advantage of this, and we'll soon have three of these, the advantage of this is that we can give them to a patient, and we're trying to work out a way we can do it at no charge. The patient just takes home this cannula. I was going to bring it and show it to you, but Dr. Steinborn needed it for a patient's way. Patient took preference. It's very small. It's about the size of a credit card. It clips on your nightgown or on a pillow. The nasal cannula is about a third the size of an oxygen cannula. All they do is wear this cannula to sleep, and it records sleep disordered breathing during the night. It records how many times a patient doesn't breathe during the night. And then it has a readout here on the little device, and we see how many apneas they have or hypopneas, and then we can do a sleep study based on the results. So it's very convenient for the patient to wear. It doesn't cost anything, and it gives the patient peace of mind. If they think they have apnea, they can use this and get peace of mind.
What's it called again?
This device is an RU sleeping from Respironics, but they're called screening devices.
Okay, just okay.
Something else that's new that I thought you'd be interested in is CMS, which is our Medicare and Medicaid services combined Medicaid and Medicare services. It's just approved home sleep testing. I don't know if any of you have read about this, or heard about it, or anything. What they're trying to do is get more patients tested at a less cost. There's a limited number of sleep labs, so they're trying to come up with a way to get more help to patients. There's they estimate about 35 million patients that need treatment, and they estimate that 80% of the population has not been treated, or the ethnic population has not been treated. This device is something that, if it is approved by our local, it's called an LCD, local coverage determination. If they approve us to use this, then we'll be able to send a patient home with this, where they live in Pinedale, wherever, Big Pine, here in Afton, whatever. This just straps on their chest. It's a three-lead device. They can wear it at home, and it'll do something similar to the screening device, only on three channels instead of one. Then we can see, we diagnose the patient, and then bring the patient in for treatment.
Just when you put in this nifty sleep lab, they come out with this, right?
No, that's the first thing I thought. So, you know, 2 years ago when I first heard this. But actually what it's doing is, you can't really give a patient, these are not accurate, they're 30%, 37% inaccurate. So that's a high percent. They're going to get better as they go along. But what they do is when we do have a patient that thinks they have a problem, we can bring them, we can give them this and screen them at a much lesser cost. And then bring them in for a full study if they can test positive. Okay, that's it. Do you guys have any questions or anything for me? I hope that was somewhat enlightening, or they're very boring. It's a tech world, but
you should make an appointment for the sleep.
Are there any natural foods, or dare I use the word supplements, that help apnea in any way? Anything that would... I know if it's a blockage, it's all physical, but is there something that helps to oxygenate the blood more, or
any type of... It helps not eat before going to bed. Gastric reflux is one of the major concerns there. Mm. What helps with the diet, blood circulation, exercise and diet help because of being able to, obesity is a problem, let's see that. It's also hereditary, you know, since there's something, there's nothing to do about it. But I don't know of anything, I haven't read anything or seen anything other than what is good for your body as far as exercise and eating properly and not eating too late before you go to bed.
So there are no prescription drugs or anything you prescribe other than, at this point in time, the CPAP machine?
There's other options for treatment. There's
Well, surgery, I guess.
Surgery. There's body positioning. Like we saw the patients where, and we have had patients where we did a study and said, okay, we recommend you sleep on your sides only. And the easiest fix for that is to sew a tennis ball in their nightshirt. So it stays on the back, and when they go to the back,
that's
they go off of it. Because you as a patient have no control over what position you sleep in. I've had patients that say, I don't sleep on my back.
Yeah.
And I say, never? No, never. They'll sleep half the night on their back. And then in the morning I'll say, did you know you slept on your back? He said, no. So, you know, you're in a sub-altered conscious, altered state of consciousness when you're asleep. And so there are other therapies as well, dental devices that work for some patients. But CPAP is non-invasive. No drugs. Once you get the machine, there's no prescriptions. You don't have to go see a doctor. That fixes the problem on most patients. So it's a preferred treatment of physicians and most patients.
But you never get away from not wearing it.
No, it's not a cure. It's a lifelong. If you wear it, you're treated. If you don't, you're not.
Okay, so with the CPAP, it forces everything to stay open.
Yes.
Now, what I'm doing, just with oxygen through the nose, that's not forcing anything to stay open.
No. See, that's why I mentioned to you that this cerebral ventilation may work for you. Because what cerebral ventilation does is it tracks your breathing pattern for 5 minutes in the past and adjusts your breathing pattern for the future. So it keeps a running record of your breathing pattern and then changes your breathing pattern over time so that you may be having central apneas and then it might take the machine 20 minutes to reduce it down to half. And an hour and a half to reduce it down to nothing. But you feel good. It's not the problem with CPAP for some patients that have this problem is that the continuous positive air coming into them keeps them awake. They don't bark and they can't breathe. It's uncomfortable. They're breathing against pressure. For 80% of patients, it's good, but for 20%, they can't tolerate it. And this cerebral ventilation machine breathes with you and changes you over a period of time. But the oxygen is not going to be forced into your lungs like it would be with cerebral ventilation. You will get some benefit from it, for sure. The other thing is if you breathe through your mouth, you get oxygen coming to the nasal passage. The body's going right back out.
What would determine that someone needs oxygen at the CPAP?
We titrate the patient first with CPAP and get rid of all the obstructions in the central apneas. And then if it has not fixed the oxygen saturation at that point, we add oxygen into the CPAP machine. So this patient was dropping down to 55s. I mean, that is low. CPAP brought him right up to normal. Some patients, usually the patients that don't come up to normal are the ones that have some type of disease in their lungs, from either smoking or from breathing, secondhand smoke, or from whatever environmental issues, there's damage to their lungs. Those are the patients that usually we have to add oxygen to after we get rid of the obstructions.
How do you determine the level of the forced air?
We start at, because we don't know the level, we start at a normal breathing pressure. So 5 centimeters is normal. And then we just keep increasing the pressure until they are limited. Sometimes, but we can only do it 1 to 2 centimeters at a time over 20 minutes to an hour, depending on the patient, because the patient has to adjust, his lungs have to adjust to the pressure. Sometimes if you do it too quick, you may overpressure the patient. So that's how we do it. It's not, you know, real complicated science, but it is a trick. I mean, it takes experience to know how to do it. Or, you know, DTaC really has, I struggled at first because you don't fix the patient. They're too much pressure and they're still not breathing. There's a lot of different tricks to it that you have to learn. It comes from experience. We do have a good success ratio. I tried to get the numbers for this meeting, but after you get them to me, I tried to get her email, and she said it wouldn't attach, and she mailed to me. Anyway, our DME companies, Medicare and Accurate, are working on a report for us from our patients since we started in last May and June until now, of what percent of them are compliant and are still using the machine. I try to call the patients the first month to see how they're doing, but it depends on my patient load and et cetera, but I get it done. But the DMEs, I'm supposed to call them 2 weeks, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days in a year, and then one DME if the patient has problems.
Do you do follow-up care to see if they're, like, if the, I'm awake now, if they need to adjust that pressure?
Yes, there's equipment really advanced. There's a smart card now. They've had it out for several years, actually, with the CPAP machines. And with the current machines, with that card, we can tell whether or not they're having apneas, hypopneas, how many hours they're using it, what their O2 is, how many RIRAs is another thing I didn't talk about. A lot of patients will have what we call a RIRA. It's a respiratory effort related arousal. There's not a drop in oxygen, but there's a drop in air volume, and then there's arousal. So the patient's still arousing to get air, but it's not severe enough to drop their oxygen. So a lot of patients have that. It picks up those too. So we have software now where the patient can call the patient. They can give me the number on their card, or they can mail it to me and I'll send it back. I can enter it into our software and it'll give me a lot of that information. Now, it's not going to give me as much with just the numbers. The numbers gives me the usage. But with the card, I can see all the events and that. Then the doctor can adjust the volume or the pressure up or down, or have them come in for another test and monitor what they're doing. So, yeah.
If you do end up seeing that through the output, the things we saw, that the legs are jumping and it's waking the patient up, and you determine that it's more a restless leg syndrome thing more than a blockage, do you continue to treat that, or do you refer them to someone that handles that type of thing? Since obviously a CPAP machine isn't going to help that as much.
None of it's just restless legs. No, Dr. Schrader does prescribe medication.
Okay.
For that. And, you know, if he feels necessary to refer to a specialist, if he will.
Okay.
Or PAD. I'll occasionally jump my whole body will jerk. It's usually a response to some dream I'm having, because I'll wake up and, oh, yeah, I fall off the cliff. Sometimes it's more often than not. I'll jump and I'll have to say dream again. But it's not often, and I don't think it keeps me awake long.
Yeah, there's arousals from dreaming. What's interesting about it is it has no significance that we know of, but in non-REM sleep, you're in black and white, and you don't remember the details. You're slowly asleep by stage 3 or 4. But if you're in REM sleep, you dream in color. Remember the details when you do your dreams. So if you remember your dreams, it's in color, it's in REM sleep. So whatever that's worth, it's not interesting.
But the other interesting point about our sleep lab, Dr. Schrader with Hudson, is within the region, the area, with all the other sleep labs, it's the length of time, the number one, get an appointment, number two, get the diagnosis in an acceptable period of time.
Number three, get the insurance.
And number three, be on the road to a treatment. And that's where our sleep lab has it over the others. It's not a period up in Jackson. The doctors associated with the sleep lab
live in Boise and Salt Lake,
and they're only there
2 days a month.
So you have that.
They should be sending people down here then, shouldn't they?
It took 2 weeks to get the study scored. It took 3 weeks to get the doctor to approve it. And then it took another week or two to get it back via mail or email, and then get the record back. So a patient was literally a month to 3 months for just a diagnosis. And believe me, that they're frustrated with it, but they didn't have any other choice. I mean, that's the way a lot of the sleep labs are, because like I said earlier, we are very lucky to have the situation we have here. There's very few labs, especially in Wyoming, that have the situation where we have a registered tech and a sleep doc in the same facility. Because I scored during the night while we study. Goes to Dr. Schrader, he has the scored record in the morning when he gets here. So I had a study last night. He had the record this morning at 7 o'clock on his desk. Mm. Then he interpreted it, and the patient had results this afternoon.
That's great.
And it doesn't always happen that quick, but usually within a week, and then our schedule. And then the diagnosis, that's the diagnosis. Then the therapy is another month to 3 months to get the therapy injected, because you have the same process. Get the patient in, get the study score, get the doctor's interpretation, get the therapy back, set them up with the machine. This is sweet here for our patients and for us.
Yeah, it's a situation where when all of a sudden sleep labs are becoming the tool of the hospitals, but you have to evaluate what your sleep lab can produce and how beneficial it can be to the patient. You have a sleep lab in Montpelier. You have a sleep lab in Jackson.
Kemmer
has a sleep lab.
Let's see, Blackfoot, you have a life of all over the valley there. Strasburg has a falls by, but we'll be done.
But the question is, how many of those sleep labs have the physician and specialist on site 24/7, as well as the tech?
Evanston, the size of the city of Evanston, they don't have a sleep doctor. They do twice as many studies as we do right now. They send all the reports to Salt Lake. They do not have cerebral ventilation therapy for their patients. They can't treat them for cerebral ventilation. They don't score their records. So, you know, we do have a good sleep lab here. So spread the word. We're helping.
So one last question: what's it cost if you have insurance, and what's it cost if you have cash?
I think it's the same because of Medicare rules. I think Medicare restricts hospitals to the cash price. Hmm. So therefore, the hospitals are just going to have one price, because that's all Medicare will pay is a cash price.
Hmm.
That's my understanding. But I don't work in accounting. I might be wrong. That's my understanding. So, but I know we're competitive with other labs, and I think we're labs are the same as most of them. And we have a doc.
If I'm not mistaken, the initial bill that I got for my test was around $1,400.
Hudson, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You want to make an appointment?
Hey, I saw you sleeping too. I saw you sleeping too.
I was only resting my eyes.
I told you there's more detail you guys want to know.
Is the, Sounds good. Very good.
Should we solve today's top secret?
Well, now why
I would like to spread the
truth. Why did you
if you can email me your presentation?
Because I've been working out since 5 a.m. Tired.
What time did you go to bed?
It's not top secret. I didn't see any patients.
9:30.
That shouldn't be an issue.
Well, it's not a case of what time you went to bed. It was a case of how much good sleep you got.
Not me.
I was at Lifetime playing racquetball from. Had to be there at 6. I have to be at Aetna at 5. And
to be well,
thanks for wrapping all up. Well,
that's my pleasure.
Lifetime.
Well, you got to get back to moving furniture. So,
so I played racquetball from
not like
6
you're getting
to
off.
8, 2 hours. Then I did treadmill, then I did circuit, the weights, and then I did the recumbent bike. And then I played some more racquetball. So I'm backed out. It's busy.